Good morning. You're listening to WTUL News and Views. Stay tuned for an update from protesters in Baton Rouge, a history of police terror in New Orleans from Malcolm Suber, community activist and founding member of People's Hurricane Relief Fund. Then Counterspin at 8:30 and Democracy Now at 9 o'clock. Following the funeral for Alton Sterling on Friday at the behest of the Sterling family, protesters paused their demonstrations. On Saturday, they were back at it. Three events took place: an early afternoon community march, a demonstration at the Triple S Food Mart, the site of Sterling's murder, and another one outside of Baton Rouge Police Headquarters. I caught up with those who gathered with food, music, signs at Circle K outside Baton Rouge Police Headquarters. Protesters there showed up to speak against the July 5th police-involved fatal shooting of Alton Sterling and widespread inequity in Louisiana's criminal justice system. The group was a few dozen in the afternoon, ballooning to 50 as the sun began to set. They held signs with messages like "Police the police," "Black lives matter," and "White silence is violence." Cars were honking in approval of the messages. I'll share a couple of memorable interactions. One pair in a pickup truck idled at a red light for a while, perplexed looks on their faces as they read the signs. When a protester spun their "White silence is violence" sign around to the side that held its lengthier message, the pair began to enthusiastically honk. The message was, "If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor." Another car pulled up, and to the amusement slash embarrassment of the elderly person in the passenger seat, the driver honked away, laying on the horn incessantly and gleefully. With so much enthusiasm and laughter from protesters and car passengers alike, the horn reached the end of its functioning life. As the light turned and the car accelerated past, the horn made its last hurrah before going silent forevermore. The site of the protest was closed Sunday morning when, in a separate incident, police held a manhunt for the Baton Rouge shooting. But the protesters gathered again outside Baton Rouge Police Headquarters Sunday evening. It's more important than ever to humanize those who gather to protest there. Few of the cars that go past harass the protesters. More passersby draw inaccurate conclusions about who the protesters are. So this morning, we'll hear an interview with Riddell, creator of The Resistance, a Baton Rouge faith-based activist group, and a short message from Melissa, a daily protester at the site.
Cool. So I'm sitting with Riddell. This is Nora from WTUL News. We're here at the Circle K in Baton Rouge at the corner of Goodwood and Airline Highway. We're across from, is this the police department?
It used to be the hospital I was born in.
Really?
Right.
When was that?
I was born in 86. It was a hospital all the way up until Bobby Jindal passed all of those laws and we had to cut the medical program.
Yeah.
So until then, it was a hospital.
So you're here at your birthplace. You've been coming out every night. Can you tell us what you do when you're here?
I try to make sure everybody has water. I try to make sure everybody has something to eat because it's hot in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And I need you to be fully fueled up, you know, to protest. I need people to be there. I need them to be, you know, have a good something on their stomach, and, you know, I'm just trying to spread a little positivity. I want to make sure that we keep it consistent, and, you know, food is always a good way to get people out, and you know, people are hungry.
So. People are excited. They're, you know, feeling all these intense feelings. Sometimes hard to remember to sleep and feed yourself.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you have experience spreading positivity. What is your background with that?
Actually, my background is real humble. Like, I've just been an activist now. I've been an activist a long time, but real, you know, as far as a serious purpose and actually bring it into fruition, it just started maybe about 4 weeks ago. So I started my faith-based organization, and I've always had a passion for it, you know, so now is the time. You know, I have the momentum, I have my family behind me, I have the community behind me, so they're encouraging me, you know. I'm not the self-proclaimed leader, I'm the voted leader, so I feel like they spoke. I didn't step up for this. So
that's just really exciting. Yeah. So what do you call yourself?
The Resistance.
The Resistance. All right, so I just saw you all taking a big picture out front here.
Right,
there's
for the
a lot
Houston
of folks.
Associated Press, yeah.
Okay, cool. So what is your main focus? What do you care about the most?
What I care about the most is reform on all aspects. Legislative reform, educational reform. I want judicial reform all the way around the board because I've seen, you know, things going on. I've been witnessing things for a long time, and, you know, I sit quiet, you know, and I kind of blame myself for letting this go on. Me and my father spoke, you know, and we've been talking real vividly about his experiences. And like he said, no one wants to step up. So at the end of the day, if you have a passion about it and you always have a gripe about it and you're not doing nothing, you have to shut up. So I feel like I want to speak my mind, so I'm going to be the first one on the front line to be doing this. So I'm not going to let anything that, you know, any premonitions that I have that may hinder me from doing this, because I feel like, you know, God has blessed me with the ability to communicate with people. God has blessed me with the ability to see things before they happen. And additionally, people have just been blessing me. You know, I really didn't want to do it, but the more and more that I, you know, continue on this path, the more and more blessings I receive. And people have shown me the heart of the city. I'm so proud of Baton Rouge. I'm so proud of the surrounding areas. I'm so proud of people around the country, you know, because I couldn't do none of this without them. Like, every time I try to do something, somebody comes and helps. Every time I feel discouraged, somebody comes and helps, like this lady right here.
Do you want to say hey?
Yeah.
Okay. This is WTUL News and Views. I'm Nora, and I'm sitting here at the Circle K in Baton Rouge. I'm with Riddell, who's of the movement.
The resistance. And I'm partnered with this young lady right here. Her name's Keena. We're from the same neighborhood, and we've been crossing paths so much, and I told her that I'm going to bug her until we get something done.
And can you tell us what folks are coming to Circle K to do and kind of what your day-to-day is here?
What we come here to do is to show a presence, show consistency, show that we're not giving up. Like, it's not going to be an overnight fluke. I'm not stopping because we've run out of gas. I'm not stopping because that we're tired. I have a mission, and my mission is clear and present, and I understand it, and I plan to follow that intensely.
So it sounds like you have a little bit of a legacy. You were talking earlier about speaking with your dad.
Yeah.
Was your family involved in protests? Did you?
Yeah, they were. I'm the descendant of slaves firsthand. My great-grandfather was born a slave, and I actually lived while he was living, and I got to speak with him as a child. And he told me about many experiences that he had, and he actually still stayed on the plantation where he was born on, where his slave master, and they still spoke. His slave master was actually his father. So I have a long legacy of resistance. You know, I come from the slaves. I come from a background of that. So I understand completely what's going on. I understand completely about the situation, what's at hand. And being a descendant of slaves directly and not knowing where I come from, but knowing that I have slaves that I come from, is, you know, it's kind of disheartening, it's kind of discouraging, but it gives me the ability to see that I've come from so little to now, you know. It's to the point now where I feel like the trials and tribulations of my family have molded my character for today.
Can you talk to us a little bit more about some of the positivity that you felt coming to you and also that you've been reflecting back to the community?
Right. You know, we get a lot of bad press here in Baton Rouge. You know, we get a lot of awful things said about us. We get a lot of ridicule, and we're antagonized a lot. But I feel like the city has the heart of a champion. I feel like throughout this troubling situation, we've shown restraint. We've shown positivity. We've shown an array of several things that never get documented, you don't get rewards for doing what you're supposed to do. But at the end of the day, I want to reiterate to my people that come out here that I see you. I notice what you're doing. Even if the press doesn't give you your due recognition, I see it. And so I see the positivity, and I see it being spread around, and it just motivates me to keep going.
And when people come to you to speak for help, what are some of the main things that they ask for, that they're concerned about, that they want in their hearts?
Mainly, equal treatment around the board. The same thing that you do for the Caucasian, we want the same thing done for blacks. I come from a background where I have an array of several different backgrounds of friends that I have, you know, from Arab countries, of Chinese descent, of Latino descent. And if I, as a black man, a descendant of a slave, can get along with anybody, I feel like everybody can do that. You know, we're all people. And I see it's this rhetoric that goes on where everybody knows it's a problem. Everybody knows it's a problem, but it's always some kind of person that has some kind of statistical data or some kind of something that they try to make some kind of evilness turn into righteousness. But you know, the whole world sees, we're in a generation now where, you know, we're in the internet generation, everybody's Facebook, and we're aware. We're very aware of what's going on. We're, you know, the millennial generation, we're not going for that. You know, I think in a little while, you know, the slave mentality will go away. That generation is slowly dying out. And I see, that's why I call my, you know, movement the resistance, because we're resisting against that. We're resisting oppression. We're resisting evil. We're resisting everything around the board. Because I have several persons in my organization that's not of African-American descent. And they're some of my most active members. And, you know, they're in this fight front row with me. And I'll never discount that, or never let anybody discount them for that struggle. And I realize we're one people. So when I'm out here, I don't care what you look like, I appreciate the presence. Because if you waste your time to come out here with us, I'll never waste your time. Yeah. You know, because at the end of the day, I appreciate their presence. I appreciate them coming out here. And that's why I try to, you know, have water for people. I try to do, because I appreciate it. And this is my way. You know, I don't have much money, but what I can show you is love with this food. That's what I can do.
And thank you for doing that.
Yeah, that's what I can do. And I felt like, you know, at the end of the day, if I can put a smile on your face and keep it positive out here, I've done my job. So I'm going to keep this fight up. You know, I'm asking for support from anybody that's supporting this mission. I'm positive. I'm faith-based. I'm a Christian. I got this movement, and I just ask that everybody just try to support me in any kind of way you can.
So the last question that I usually like to ask folks is, like, what is your dream for what we can possibly be? Can you describe that, maybe with a story?
Yeah, my dream is for me to be able to be riding down the street and get pulled over, and the same procedure that's done for the Caucasian is done for me. I'm tired of getting handcuffed and not taken to jail. I'm tired of getting pulled over and nothing's happened but harassment. I'm tired of, to the point where if I'm abused, who can I tell? You know, it's like when you try to report these police officers to, you know, internal affairs, it's a buddy system. If you try to tell on them, they're not gonna go, you know, and do anything. So I want it to the point where everybody's accountable. Every man gets the same treatment around the board. Nobody, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And that's all I want. At the end of the day, equal treatment. I'm not asking for nothing that we not do. And I feel like that's a reasonable request, you know?
I think so, too. I'm with you. So can you maybe just recap how people can get in touch with you, where you're at, on Twitter or
Instagram, or whatever. I'm coming with all my websites. My website will be up tomorrow. It's going to be The Resistance. Everything will be The Resistance. And I'll have that up for you. I'll be in touch with you to keep you updated on that. But like I say, I'm not funded right now, so everything that I do is coming out of pocket. So it's taking me a little bit longer to kind of get set up for everything. But God is working with me slowly but surely. And I know I have faith in my community. I have faith in Louisiana. I have faith in the country. And I know that I'm going to get this going because I'm doing this positive. I'm doing it the right way. I'm transparent. And I feel like it's going to happen.
Okay. Thank you for talking with me.
No problem. Nice to meet you.
If you just tuned in, that was Riddell over in Baton Rouge, across the street from the police headquarters, protesting. That was Saturday evening. Next, we're going to hear from Melissa.
Can you tell us about being out here?
Okay, it just seemed like it's just a lot of community unity. Like it's drawing us. This event, this tragedy, has drawn all colors and all different walks of life together. And it's so much respect and love out here. We look beyond the color, and I meet new people every day. This is like my third day protesting, so I meet new people every day, and it's just a joy and a blessing to meet new people, you know?
Yeah. Tell us what your main passion is that's bringing you out here.
I just would like justice for the Sterling family and all other families that has died of tragedy involving the police. And I would like a lesson learned, as far as I want people to just really see that, you know, it's just not right, you know. And lessons learned for me, as far as, you know, never judge a book by its cover.
So before we close out here, Melissa, can you tell me, like, what is the world that you dream of? Can you just describe something that would be possible for us that you in your dreams?
I would like change to come regarding the judicial system. And I would like to also see, more cops interact with the community. you know, I love the cops also, but I love also justice, you know, fairness. I want everyone to be treated equally.
You're listening to WTUL News and Views. If you just tuned in, you heard from Riddell and Melissa, protesters who gather at Baton Rouge Police Headquarters to speak up against the July 5th police-involved fatal shooting of Alton Sterling and widespread inequity in Louisiana's criminal justice system. Next up, we hear from Malcolm Suber, New Orleans community activist on moral panics and mass incarceration in the neoliberal city. Suber presents a timeline of communities speaking up against police terror, which is deeply important to learn and know given today's movement. This audio is credited to Katrina After 10, a program that brought together activists, artists, and intellectuals to discuss critical issues such as environmental racism, gender discrimination, gentrification, mass incarceration, education, and privatization, as well as the history and future of social movements in New Orleans. An archive of their work is available from Brown University on YouTube.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I call my presentation Disrupting the Pipeline to Prison in New Orleans, 2005-2015. What's important to understand, of course, is that the history of police violence against black bodies in New Orleans has a long, long history. So is our fight back against police violence, police terror. In fact, in New Orleans, we don't even call it police brutality anymore. We call it police terror because that's what it actually is. It is terror. It is systematic, it's organized, and it's aimed at keeping black folks in their place. Louisiana leads the world in incarceration. New Orleans leads Louisiana in incarceration. The New Orleans ruling class has decided that the way to deal with poverty and inequality is to arrest black bodies. Activists in New Orleans have been waging a determined fight to derail the incarceration train by radically reforming two elements of the criminal justice system, the NOPD and the Orleans Parish Prison, OPP. New Orleans Police Department and Orleans Parish Prison are both under supervision of federal consent decrees right now. These consent decrees exist because of the hard work and dedication of police and prison reform activists in New Orleans. We consciously sought to disrupt the pipeline to prison in New Orleans. Today, I'll discuss how we got these consent decrees and the lessons learned from our struggle. Ostensibly, Mayor Landrieu appoints the police superintendent, and the police superintendent answers to the mayor. Now, the NOPD is supervised by Federal District Judge Susie Morgan. The NOPD entered into a consent decree with the federal government in 2013. And Judge Morgan is supposed to make sure that the NOPD is making progress towards constitutional policing. Ostensibly, Sheriff Marlon Gussman runs the OPP. Now he must answer to a federal district judge, Lance Afric. In 2009, the United States Department of Justice, after investigating conditions at OPP, sent a highly critical report. And it reads, I quote, "We find that the OPP fails to adequately protect inmates from harm from staff and other inmates, fails to provide inmates with adequate mental health care, fails to provide adequate suicide prevention, fails to provide adequate medication management, fails to provide safe and sanitary environmental conditions, and fails to provide adequate fire safety precautions." In 2012, 10 inmates in OPP filed a lawsuit alleging frequent rapes, beatings, and stabbings. Following the filing of the lawsuit, Sheriff Gussman agreed to a consent decree with the Department of Justice. These decrees both emanated from complaints of activists and pleas from victim families for justice that the mayor and the sheriff, of course, were ignoring. There has always been a sizable cadre of community activists who challenged police terror and police murder prior to Hurricane Katrina. I was chairman of the Afro-American Liberation League, which organized families to oppose police abuse. For instance, in early 2005, we had been conducting a struggle around the police murder of Jannard Thomas, a 25-year-old black man who was killed in the Upper Ninth Ward. In fact, the Monday before Hurricane Katrina hit, we were having demonstrations with some of our students from Douglas High School protesting his murder. Our many years of struggle against the NLPD terror has taught us that the capitalist state apparatus protects its own. The U.S. criminal justice system, from the police to the coroner, to the district attorney, and to the courts, all support the oppression by police aimed at keeping the working class and poor in their oppressed condition. We also learned through bitter experience that even our victories, when we get a police charge with a crime, are temporary. One of the organizations that developed after the Katrina was the Community United for Change, and that organization organized itself and called for the Department of Justice to come into New Orleans and take over the NLPD. This was issued, of course, because nothing was done about the murders that occurred on the Danziger Bridge, and the local justice system would not prosecute these murderers. In the aftermath of the massive flooding in New Orleans after the levees broke, news reports re-victimized Black New Orleanians by portraying them as lawless looters. Governor Kathleen Blanco announced that she was dispatching the National Guard to New Orleans with the orders to shoot looters. Warren Riley, deputy police chief, was reported as having given orders to cops to fire at will on looters. The NLPD acted on these instructions. On September 2, 2005, Henry Glover, a 32-year-old Black man, was gunned down by police sniper David Warren. Glover was out with a friend looking for food. Warren, carrying his personal hunting rifle, shot him from 100 feet away. He claimed that Glover was threatening his life. Henry Glover was gravely wounded. A Good Samaritan, William Tanner, put Glover in his car and drove to a school where the police had a staging area. Instead of helping Mr. Glover, they pulled Tanner out and beat him and took the car and drove it behind the 4th District Station and set it on fire. The NLPD, of course, tried to cover up this murder of Mr. Glover and was telling his family they didn't know where he was. On September 3rd, you got to remember these are the days immediately after August 29th. On September 3rd, 45-year-old Danny Brumfield was killed by the NLPD officer Ronald Mitchell as he tried to flag down a car for help in front of the convention center. On September 4th, of course, we had the two families trying to cross the Danziger Bridge, and they were set upon by the New Orleans Police Department, who drove up in a van, a moving truck, a budget rental truck, got out of the truck and started firing. And of course, two of those members of the two families were killed, including James Brissett, a 17-year-old kid. I understand he was also in your program, right? Right. And further up the bridge, Ronald Madison, a mentally challenged 40-year-old, was killed by the police. Four other people were wounded, including Susan Bartholomew, who was a 38-year-old mother who had her arm shot off by NLPD. These three outrageous cases of police murder in the days following Katrina served as a galvanizing event which allowed for a coalition of individuals and organizations to agree to work together with the families to get justice for their loved ones. Years passed, and finally in 2006, Eddie Jordan, the city's first Black DA, indicted the Danziger cops. When they turned themselves in, they were held as heroes by the NLPD officers. In fact, they had a rally in front of the police, the courthouse on Broad Street, and cheered them as they turned themselves in. A state judge, of course, refused to accept the charges from DA Eddie Jordan and threw the cases out. And finally, we were able to get the federal government to come in. In 2007, the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, a coalition of progressive and progressive forces fighting for the right of Katrina victims to return to New Orleans, held an international tribunal. The tribunal presented testimony from police terror victims to a panel of international judges from 7 countries. The Madison family, led by Dr. Ramel Madison, a prominent dentist in New Orleans, was able to get support from the National Dental Association and the Congressional Black Caucus to finally get the Department of Justice to come to New Orleans to investigate the NOPD. In that period, the Community United for Change launched a series of town hall meetings where we call people from all quarters of the city to come and testify about the activities of the New Orleans Police Department. In those hearings, we came up with a list of 20 uninvestigated, unindicted, uncharged cases of murder at the hands of the NOPD that we submitted to the Justice Department. In the spring of 2011, the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department issued its findings letter. This findings letter confirmed all of the complaints that we had made about the terrorist activity of the New Orleans Police Department. It stated that the NOPD had a long history of unconstitutional policing. It stated that the NOPD was in need of a radical reform in all areas. It also pointed out that outside employment policies of the NOPD, which allowed rank and file police to provide detailed employment for their superiors, was the center of, or as they called it, the aorta of corruption. Mayor Landrieu accepted this and pledged that he was going to work with us to rein in his terrorist police organization. But he wanted to assume the posture that he was for police reform. He fired Warren Riley and announced a search committee for a new police chief. He even invited some of the anti-police terror activists to join his committee. But of course, this was just posturing. He rejected the choices of that committee and appointed his childhood friend, Ronald Surpass. Surpass, of course, would be proved to be an opponent of change within the department, and we had to launch a struggle there to get rid of Surpass. Beginning in 2010, the CUC began to hold a series of town hall meetings designed to draft a people's consent decree, outlining the residents' vision of what a reformed NOPD would look like. The People's Consent Decree included demand for body cameras on police, a 20-hour limit on outside employment of police officers, a residency requirement, and most important, a civilian review board with subpoena power to investigate charges of police misconduct. This was, of course, in addition to overcoming the Office of Municipal Investigation, which had been started after the Algiers killings in the 1980s, but which had no subpoena power. And we want, the last thing that we argued for was that we wanted seats at the table, along with the city and the Justice Department, to administer a consent decree. And we cited Cincinnati, Ohio, as an example of community having its representative at the negotiation tables. In 2010, 2011, the Justice Department won convictions of the cops who shot and covered up the murder of Henry Glover. They also won convictions of the cops who beat Raymond Robert to death prior to Hurricane Katrina. Also in 2010, 21-year-old Adolf Grimes was murdered in front of his grandmother's house. He was set upon by NOPD plainclothes officers in the early hours and prosecuted. The interesting thing, of course, is the Department of Justice, even though we presented solid evidence, refused to accept this case. Their lawyers told CUC that they could not afford to prosecute this case, that they did not have enough money to do it in their budget. In February 2012, the Department of Justice was still in New Orleans conducting its investigations when a raid on a house in Gentilly resulted in the murder of 20-year-old Wendell Allen. The NOPD stormed the house, which had five children under age 10, claiming it was a drug house. Wendell Allen was asleep in the upstairs bedroom, and when he heard the commotion, he ran to the top of the stairs, and he was shot down by New Orleans police officer Joseph Coklaw. The officer, of course, claimed that he saw a weapon. Luckily, there was an officer who had his own personal body camera on, and he captured the whole event on his body camera. And instead of confessing that this was a bad shoot, they went after the officer with the body camera and tried to prosecute him for bringing outside materials onto the job. Then on March 1st, at 5:30 a.m. in the morning, Justin Sipp, on his way to work at a Burger King, was shot and killed by New Orleans police officer Stephen Girard. Girard was working on a private detail. One of the features in New Orleans since Katrina has been the proliferation of private details where communities, middle class, white communities, hire off-duty New Orleans policemen to patrol their areas. One of the consequences of that is that young black people who venture into those districts are ran out by these police, and they are directed to keep blacks out of that area. So at 5:30 in the morning, a young man who has decided that he wants to do the right thing on the way to work is assaulted by New Orleans police and killed. And this is why, while the Justice Department is in town investigating the misadventures of the New Orleans police. Okay. All right. Also, at the same time, simultaneously, the Orleans Parish Prison Reform Coalition has been struggling to improve the conditions of the Orleans Parish Jail. There were 6,000 prisoners in Orleans Parish Prison when Hurricane Katrina hit the city, making it the second largest prison in the country. And we were campaigning to reduce the number of inmates, and the OPPC, the Orleans Parish Prison Reform Coalition, won a concession that the rebuilding of the prison, we would not have more than 1,400 inmates, which is more in conformity with the size of our city. This, of course, had to be accompanied with an agreement by the NOPD that they were going to quit locking up people for minor problems. One of the ways in which they fund the jails in New Orleans has been to pick up people for minor offenses and put them in jail, and the jail is funded by the number of prisoners in there, and they get a per diem per prisoner. And so we have gotten an agreement from the city that they, instead of taking people to jail for minor offenses now, they are issuing tickets that you can go and take care of. But that's one of the ways that we're trying to disrupt the amount of people who are incarcerated needlessly. And of course, if you build a prison with 6,000 beds, you're going to fill it. And that is going to make sure that the New Orleans police interact more frequently, more viciously with the residents there. And of course, what we have learned is that this impossible situation that we're faced with has to be met by massive resistance, and we have sought to organize ourselves. And even in this organization, we realize that the federal government is not our friend in this situation. The federal government has gone along with the oppression, and that oppression is meant to keep black people and poor working people in their place. And that's the story of New Orleans, and we can talk tomorrow in the question and answer. Thank you.